This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. On Sunday, the U.S. women's national team took home the FIFA World Cup. That's the fourth World Cup title for a team that's been ranked number one by FIFA for 10 of the last 11 years. And while it was certainly a stunning game, this particular win was about much more than soccer. That's the sound of fans at the Women's Soccer World Cup final in France just as the game ended. Their cries echo the ongoing battle for fair pay, which the U.S. team is currently fighting in court. Lindsay Gibbs and Brenda Elsie have been following the cup and the many political and economic conversations behind the sport. They're two of the co-hosts of the feminist sports podcast Burn It All Down, and they join me now. Lindsay Gibbs is a Greensboro native and a sports reporter with Think Progress. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Brenda is a professor of history at Hofstra University. Welcome back, Brenda.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we've heard a ton of post-game analysis in the past few days. So Lindsay, I want to start first with the North Carolina connection. This team has major North Carolina connections. So many of the players spent time on pitches here in North Carolina. Tell us about the state's role in this team's success.
Yeah, so there are about five players, I believe, who went to North Carolina University, at Chapel Hill, which, of course, has a phenomenal women's soccer program. You have Crystal Dunn, Jessica McDonald, among many others. And there are also four players who play on the National Women's Soccer League's North Carolina team, the North Carolina Courage. You have Abby Dahlkemper, Jessica McDonald, Crystal Dunn, and Samantha Mewis. And the Courage actually won the NWSL championship last year. So a lot of reasons for North Carolina fans to be extremely happy about what we saw and extremely excited about getting to follow some of these players up close and personally.
Brenda, you've been following this game for a long time, and as a historian, I'm wondering what stood out to you about this particular match, kind of looking at the landscape of women's soccer.
Well, this particular match to me was the marquee event of what has been indicative of the tournament more broadly, which is it's been a really politicized tournament. And the athletes themselves, whether it's Argentina, Nigeria, and certainly the U.S. women's team led by Megan Rapinoe, have been totally conscious and expressive about how they see this as a platform for gender equality and also sometimes racial injustice and other things that they want at LGBT rights. So it's been tremendous in terms of seeing the solidarity between the teams, between the women. And it's different than anything that I've seen.
Yeah, as you're saying, we didn't really even have a moment to kind of embrace the win before those chants began for equal pay that we just heard. So, Lindsay, tell us about that post-game moment. What struck you when the fans started chanting equal pay?
Just the fact that it's become so synonymous with this team, with this moment. I mean, we talk about on our podcast all the time, there is no separating the politics from sports, especially when it comes to women's sports. And I think you're seeing, you know, society as a whole really grasp onto that now. And it's because these players have been so brave. I mean, to have a two-time defending World Cup champion team suing their federation for equal pay while they are trying to defend their World Cup title and speaking about it at every available chance, not backing down at any moment. It's just incredibly powerful. And I think those equal pay chants, to have that raining down with, you know, president of U.S. soccer, the president of FIFA all there with, you know, a video of this streaming out to the entire world. That's not by accident. That's because these players have seized the moment and they have made this conversation about equal pay synonymous with who they are.
Well, exactly, because it's not a new conversation. There was a settlement that took place in 2017 after a bunch of high-profile players filed a complaint. They came to a decision. Those details we don't really know, but now there's a new lawsuit that was filed in March. So, Brenda, where are we now? What is this current lawsuit and what are the women fighting for?
So as far as I understand it, the lawsuit is now being, well, they agreed to stop and wait for mediation until after the World Cup. which seems to me just a brilliant strategy. I don't know Lindsay's opinion on this, but for me, I was thinking to myself, you know, that is a really good idea. And I think it's borne out in the way that the tournament advanced and the way they kept that conversation on the table. And they have been helped by the very same sorts of fights being fought all over the world. So the fact that Ada Hegerberg did not play, the best player in the world, because of equal pay. So I like totally props to the U.S. women, but I also think it's really important to remember that this is like a global movement. And it's one that the U.S. are leading, but are also in arms with a lot of other teams.
Right. So this is playing out, obviously, around the world. And it's curious, though, because in the U.S., what it seems to me, the response from U.S. soccer, at least to what was stated so far, is they say, OK, yeah, there are these inequities, but it's a result of this different pay structure that we have.
Yeah.
So what is this pay structure and where do the numbers actually shake out?
Well, they're going to blame FIFA, right? So they're going to say it's FIFA's fault because their prize money and subsidies for women's soccer aren't the same. But FIFA in no way precludes the federation from making up that money.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a straw argument, right? It's not going to hold up. I don't see how it could anyway. To blame an international body that subsidizes you, it's still within U.S. Soccer Federation's capacity to decide to pay them equally.
So we're kind of looking at two separate things here. We're looking at both what they're paid by the U.S. Federation as well as the discrepancies in the FIFA amounts. But even if you look at the pure economic argument, Lindsay, that, you know, some people are saying, OK, well, women don't bring in the same kind of funding. That really doesn't even hold water. Can you tell us about kind of what we're seeing in terms of the viewership and the amount of kind of revenue that these women are generating?
Yeah, so the 2015 Women's World Cup final is still the most watched soccer match in the history of the United States. If you look back in 2016 and 2017, the women brought in about $9 million in net revenue. So that's after all the expenses were paid. Whereas the men only earned for U.S. soccer about $3 million in net revenue. If you look at their gate receipts, which is how much the games that they're playing actually earn, it was about equal over a couple of year period here. From 2015 to 2017, I believe, with the women out earning the men a little bit. You have most recently, during the World Cup, the women's jersey, the women's U.S. women's national team home jersey, became the number one selling soccer jersey of all time, men's or women's, on Nike.com. So you're just seeing time and time again that they are more than carrying their weight within this federation. But like Brenda said, U.S. soccer likes to blame a lot of outside forces for why they have to be discriminatory with their pay. And what this comes down to is it's time for U.S. soccer to pave the way forward on this issue, to stop with excuses, to rethink how this is done. Even the men's team, which you could be conspiratorial and say they're only saying this because they're not earning much bonus money this these days with their lack of qualifying for the World Cup. But, you know, there's been arguments that why don't we put all of this FIFA bonus money that everyone is earning into the same pot and draw from there? And I think that's the answer going forward. Another excuse, I should say, that U.S. soccer often uses is the fact that the women don't make enough during their club soccer careers that they have to be paid salaries by the U.S. soccer to kind of be on the national team. So those 23 players who are on the U.S. women's national team get a salary and benefits from U.S. soccer. But who controls the salaries that these women are getting in their club leagues? U.S. soccer is one of the owners of the National Women's Soccer League. So that, too, to me, doesn't hold water because they could help the women get more just for playing in the National Women's Soccer League if they chose to.
Well, exactly. There has to be this infrastructure in place to set the women up for success and to be able to achieve these particular things. There's obviously a lot of systemic things that need to be worked out. There's also this question of marketing. I want to play a really interesting, very moving but interesting ad by Nike that was released right after the end of the women's game. So let's hear a little bit of a clip.
And I believe that we will make our voice voice is heard, and TV shows will be talking about us every single day and not just once every 4 years, and that women will conquer more than just the soccer field, like breaking every single glass ceiling and having their faces carved on Mount Rushmore, and that we'll keep fighting not just to make history, but to change it forever!
That's a clip from a recent Nike ad that was released following the U.S. women's win at the FIFA World Cup. I'm talking with Lindsay Gibbs and Brenda Elsie, two of the co-hosts of the feminist sports podcast Burn It All Down. So, Lindsay, you had a strong reaction to that ad. Tell me why.
Yeah, well, it was a very moving ad. I got chills, and then I got angry because Nike is one of the main partners and sponsors with U.S. soccer. And couldn't they just make it so that things are equal? Couldn't they step up and put pressure on U.S. soccer, even pressure on FIFA, to do better about these things? The soccer world needs Nike's money. It needs Nike's support. Nike is a multi-billion dollar company that yields so much power. And you know, I'm sick of it. What if Nike says to U.S. soccer, no, we need these contracts to be equal. Stop coming up with excuses or we're not going to partner with you going forward. You know, we've seen Visa step up and say, you know, our money needs to be split 50-50 between the men and the women because U.S. soccer bundles their rights. So you can sponsor, you can give U.S. soccer money and not know if it's going to the men's team or the women's team because of the way they kind of bundle sponsors and television broadcast deals. So you've seen Visa step up and mandate that at least 50% of the money that they're giving U.S. soccer goes towards the women. You've seen companies like Adidas step up and say, we will definitely give all of the athletes that we sponsor in the Women's World Cup equal bonuses that they would get in the Men's World Cup. And yet you have Nike just kind of releasing these inspirational commercials. And that frustrates me. And I'm not saying Visa and Adidas are perfect by any stretch of the imagination. And there's certainly a lot more about both of those deals that I would like to know. But I'm just kind of over people selling, you know, these women as such inspirations. Don't get me wrong. I find them incredibly inspiring. But things like that ad from Nike or FIFA's slogan for the Women's World Cup, which was Dare to Shine, it just at a certain point, it seems kind of patronizing to me.
Well, Brenda, so obviously there's a lot to talk about in terms of money and marketing and branding, but there's another really big conversation happening about this particular World Cup win, about the social politics and how queerness is playing out on the soccer pitch. There's a famous moment that everyone remembers from 2015 where Abby Wambach kissed her wife on camera, and it was a really big deal, and a lot of people were talking about it. Now you have this tournament where there are so many different kinds of queer representation. You have players like Megan Rapinoe who are very vocal, very out. And then you have people like Kelly O'Hara who go up to their partner after the game, have a kiss, but don't make any kind of public statement about their sexual orientation. So what did this game kind of signify for you about where we are in the conversation around LGBTQ athletes and soccer in particular?
Well, I mean, it's wonderful to see the kind of support for Pride that this team has had and the way in which it's even on the social media of the U.S. Women's Soccer official, you know, Twitter account and things. I do think there's a marked difference between the U.S. and the experience of other teams who have been totally terrorized by homophobia. So it is a very white, very European and U.S. privilege right now, and that I think is deeply troubling. So for Brazil, for Nigeria, there have been reports throughout the last years of ways in which the players have been bullied by their coaches, have been victims of homophobic abuse, and I love this story, and I love the U.S. women's team, but I also think it's great for them and it's important. And I hope that it sort of paves the way for these other places, but I don't think that's going to happen by itself. And I think part of that is looking at global soccer and not just sort of isolating the U.S. women's team from global men's soccer as well, because we're still having in the U.S. right now during the Gold Cup, the homophobic P chant that is being chanted incessantly when the U.S. played Mexico. And so it's, you know, it's wonderful what's happening and the activism of these athletes. At the same time, they really are a minority in a very larger scale, which should be both to appreciate them, but also to ask ourselves, okay, so how do we get to the point where this is the norm?
Well, there's a conversation to be had as well when you look at the finals of the Women's World Cup. We don't really see much representation of, or really any at all, of the Global South. So there is a bigger international conversation at play. We don't have a ton of time, but Brenda, can you talk a bit about kind of this, the system of colonialism, and why we're not seeing the Global South well represented as we get to these final matches?
Well, I mean, because soccer diffused from investment, it didn't just magically happen. It didn't like land one day and everyone was like, this is so awesome, everybody should play it. It was what they decided was proper for masculine development, national identity. And so there has been investment, billions of dollars in the case of Brazil in 2014, to make this sport popular. And just as you find economics and the economics of colonialism that's going to push out the Global South from other kinds of economic spheres, they've been at a disadvantage in terms of modern sport as well. And so there's a recognition that has to be made. And it's very troubling, I think, when you see FIFA try to sort of, or maybe not even FIFA, but journalists sort of trying to obfuscate this gross inequality when they say things like, well, France is the last African team in the Cup. It's like, no, it's not. It has diasporic players, and that's really important. But we can't ignore the fact that there's a huge economic disparity between Europe, the United States, Canada, and everybody else, and Australia.
Well, there's so much more to talk about. I wish we had more time, but I will point people to your podcast, Burn It All Down, as a place to hear much more sports analysis. I'm talking with Lindsay Gibbs and Brenda Elsie, two of the co-hosts of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find out more about their podcast and the two of them. Lindsay is a sports reporter with Think Progress. Brenda is an associate professor of history at Hofstra University. All of that at our website, stateofthings.org.